The Guardian.
On Monday night in the Vasil Levski National Stadium, England beat Bulgaria 6-0 in a routine European qualifier. Away from the pitch, past the running track, in the stands, a group of Bulgarian fans booed black England players every time they touched the ball, made monkey chants, and were caught on camera performing Nazi salutes. This is a special episode of Football Weekly in which, together with some experts in their field, we'll explore what happened on Monday night, what the fallout has been, and whether this was a watershed moment. So over the next hour, we'll talk about the UEFA protocol, the reactions of the fans, the players' decision to stay on the pitch, and what sanctions UEFA should impose, and what sanctions we think they will impose. Before I introduce the panel, let's speak to Barney Ronay, who was there covering the game for The Guardian. In the build-up before the game, we had those quotes from the Bulgarian manager, Krasimir Balakov, saying England had a bigger problem with racism. And then we had the head of the Bulgarian FA criticising Gareth Southgate. What was that build-up like? You were over there.
It was a strange build-up. I mean, the quotes from Balakov at the time were quite incendiary, but also it was hard. It's hard not to think that he has some kind of point in some way. I mean, nobody's going to pretend there's not a problem with racism in Britain. I mean, I wrote an article in the days before about our fans and how, you know, the habit of going abroad and occupying European town centre squares, smashing things up, singing songs about Germans. So this is, this is xenophobia. You know, this is not how you behave at home. And before we start preaching at the rest of the world, we definitely need to get our own house in order. So there was some sense that Balakov was saying something that not everybody in Britain perhaps appreciates, but having seen him post-match, my opinion of Balakov has changed dramatically, and indeed of the whole Bulgarian approach to this, which was deeply depressing on top of what we saw in the stadium.
What are your memories of the game?
It was horrendous. It was, I mean, as an observer, it was horrible to watch. It was really distressing. The stadium itself was, you know, the section that was closed was mirrored by a massive empty section on the other side. There's absolutely no hardship whatsoever in closing a section of that stadium as a punishment for racism. It's an absurd thing, but it was half full anyway. We heard the first racist chants very clearly. From the press box, it was Tyrone Mings got the ball. The section right next to where he was on the far side immediately went off, and we saw Mings turn and look at them and then look at the linesman. And you saw exactly what had happened instantly. And it didn't let up. I mean, obviously we had the two stoppages, but it was still going on through the second half, even when those deeply unpleasant overtly fascist ultras had left the stadium, it was still going on. This wasn't just a few people. This were quite a lot of separate pockets.
It's interesting how much it sounded like it affected you, given the amount of football matches that you have covered, right?
Well, yeah, but this wasn't really a football match at all. The whole thing, the idea of sport, I mean, for a start, Bulgaria are absolutely dreadful, but the whole idea that this was a sporting event sort of fell apart almost immediately. I mean, obviously, it wasn't. You don't feel these things. It wasn't directed at me, but I felt it intensely personally, as did everyone watching. Partly because you know exactly how the players on the pitch are feeling. Partly because, you know, racism is an affront to everyone. You know, even when you're not suffering it directly yourself. It's an affront to the idea of a functioning world. And also, personally. You know, Bulgaria has a problem with you know, formerly hard right groups. And to me, it was personally distressing to see people giving Nazi salutes and swastikas. This was more than racism at football. I mean, this is yet another symptom of the world being in a very dangerous place. And these things often come out of football because there are no other elements in society where people get together and basically shout things at each other and form this kind of collective expression of how they feel. So things come out of football that are there in other ways throughout society, and football becomes this kind of cauldron for it.
Watching on the TV, you got a sense that it was quieter in the second half, but from where you were, it was still happening. The monkey charting was still happening.
Yeah, absolutely. And Gareth Southgate spoke to the UEFA delegate at times. England could have walked off under the ridiculous protocol. They could have activated that because it was still going on. I mean, everyone will have their own view on this, and there is no correct view, but personally I was glad they stayed out there because it was, I don't know if it was defiant exactly, I felt that they showed amazing composure, and there was a certain glee also in just thrashing the other team in the middle of this. But they decided, for whatever reason, it's entirely up to them to stay on. I think creating a protocol and the idea of how you should respond to somebody abusing you, and effectively, let's not forget, committing a crime against your person. It's up to you how you want to respond to that. This is a hugely emotional business, and UEFA's idea that there are three stages you must follow is ridiculous. Mm. Do whatever feels right in the moment. Next time, they might be right to walk off. It's up to them. But this time, they stayed out there.
In the press conference afterwards, there were reports that a cameraman told Gareth Southgate to fuck off. I mean, and you mentioned Balakov's totally bizarre response from him.
I mean, that man is... I mean, it was the most cowardly, disgusting press conference I've ever seen. He pretended he couldn't hear what was going on. He's lying. Of course he could. And he said, let's just talk about the football, which is a strange thing to say when your team had just lost 6-0 and you score once in four games. You'd think he might be glad of the distraction. But no, I mean, it was horrendous. And the Bulgarian journalists were laughing throughout the whole thing, making jokes about the response of the British to this problem in their stadium. There was no remorse there. There was no shame or embarrassment. And when people say Bulgaria should be banned from international football, it's tempting to think, yes, they should. But you also wonder where that would leave them, because nobody in that room cared. It was quite shocking in itself.
Listen, Barney, thanks so much for coming on and setting the scene. Appreciate it.
Okay, thanks.
Barney Ronnie there, who covered the game for the paper. Now in the studio, Barry Glendenning is here. Hey, Baz.
Hello.
Troy Townsend, head of development for Kick It Out.
Hi.
Busy couple of days.
Indeed,
Troy. Yeah. I'm not saying you're not always busy. And Elliot Ross, football and politics expert from The Correspondent magazine, amongst many other things. Elliot, thanks for coming in.
Hi, Max.
You've all heard what Barney had to say there, and we're going to cover this in sort of forensic detail in the next hour or so. I just wanted to get a sense of what you've made of the past 2 days, what happened and what you've made in the past couple of days, Troy?
As I listen to Barney, you know, it's great. You know, I've done interviews and spoken about this from afar, just on what I visibly saw and heard and kind of like knowing the topic subject. But listening to Barney, someone who was out there, someone that would have had to experience it and has kind of embraced the whole period of time that he was out in Bulgaria, I'm bubbling. I'm getting angry, and I'm angry anyway. And Max, you'll know that's not an unusual thing, but I'm angry now because of how it was continued to be allowed. I knew that there was chanting in the second half. I'm not down with this protocol stuff. It fails because UEFA do not want to see anyone walk off of their football pitch. I'm angry that the fans who are notorious were allowed in the ground, so shutting a closing a section of the ground actually meant that they just went and sat or stood in another area of the same ground. So, just born out anger. And to hear, I mean, you can hear it in Barney's voice. Mm. And if you can hear it in Barney's voice, you know, when finally get to talk to those players, wow, you know, that's an experience that no one should have to go through.
Elliot?
I mean, I think it's becoming pretty clear that people are not happy with the protocols and how they're going to work. Particularly in as much as we kind of remain within a space on this issue defined by a lot of very bold rhetoric, right? So you hear a lot about zero tolerance. You heard Ciafarin, the president of UEFA, talking about waging war on racism in football. And I think we've got to the point where it's just very clear that the punishments need to be much, much stronger. At the same time, I've been somewhat heartened by what I see is quite an unusual thing, which was both Southgate and Greg Clark coming out and saying that there's issues to be resolved at home, and that they were not willing to just simply judge or stand in judgment of Bulgaria and the Bulgarian situation. Perhaps just owning the fact that they don't probably know very much about it, right? Mm. But they do know about the situation at home, and they do know that there are still serious questions to be answered here. And that seems like a move. I don't think that's happened on its own. I think work by people like Troy, people like Eni Aluko has been fundamental to that. And at the same time, you're seeing there is still a kind of self-congratulatory vein here, right? Like I can't remember which tabloid newspaper it was that led with England 6, racism 0. And I don't know how widely felt that sentiment is. But yeah.
And you've sort of felt that as well, Barry, right?
What happened in Bulgaria was awful. I feel particularly sorry for Tyrone Mings, whose debut it was in an England shirt, and he'll look back on what should be an incredibly proud moment. It probably was an incredibly proud moment. And that is how he will remember it, and that shouldn't happen. I've been in the pub in the company of a friend. I've seen him being racially abused. He's a middle-aged man, and to see how upsetting it was for him was heartbreaking for me. You know, it's just, he was traumatized, and I think it never really hit home for me before then quite how bad racism can be. But I do think that there is an element of, as an outsider, I'm not English, I have lived here for a long time, but kind of a do as we say, not as we do edge to their, some of the pontificating I've heard in recent days, you know, but Boris Johnson describing what happened as a stain on football, you know, Boris Johnson describes black people as pickaninnies with watermelon smiles, you know, half his front bench, you could argue, are racist. And let's not forget that a couple of days before this happened in Bulgaria, England fans, a section of them, as is now customary, I think for the fourth time this year in different European cities, behaved deplorably in Prague. They vandalized things, they were antisocial, they were singing their repertoire of songs that many people find offensive. And in a couple of weeks' time, it's going to be poppy season, which is also open season on James McLean, mm-hmm. when he is inevitably barracked by large sections of fans in grounds, including his own fans of his own team. Will there be calls for teams to be docked points because he's been called a Fenian this, a Fenian that? Will there be calls for sections of the Britannia or wherever else to be closed? No, there won't. And I think the outrage we've heard about what happened in Bulgaria is totally justified. It's the selectivity of some of the outrage that ticks me off.
The Bulgarian manager, as Barney mentioned, Krasimir Balakov, said before the game, English game has more of a problem with racism than Bulgaria does. His direct quote, "There have been incidents in various levels of English football involving racism, which I consider something normal because it's a big country with a very diverse population. We don't have this problem in Bulgaria. I can assure you of that." Troy, that obviously looks ridiculous now, that quote. And what was your sense of the threat of this kind of thing in the lead up to the game?
By the way, he's spot on with his quote. He's absolutely spot on. And what Barney has said,
He's spot on with the first half of that.
First half of his quote. Because, you know, let's be serious. We've been calling out racism for forever and a day in this country. We ignored some massive incidents last season. And when I say we ignored them, we didn't call them for what they were. You know, bananas on a football pitch 30 years after the image of John Barnes kicking that banana off at Goodison Park. We failed to acknowledge that for what it was. The week later, Raheem Sterling, although, you know, two people that were allegedly racially abusing Raheem Sterling, the the Court of Justice found that they had nothing to answer to. So, yeah, there are massive incidents. There's been incidents this season. But we kind of set ourselves up for Monday night. So I wasn't surprised at all at what I saw and what I witnessed on Monday night, because it was all the talk before the game. And did we inflame them a little bit, or is that just their nature? For me, it's probably just their nature, but they were probably angry enough to go, well, this is going to happen regardless. Those Bulgarian supporters actually were sticking two fingers up consistently to UEFA whilst doing what they were doing in the ground, because they were being accused, quite rightly. They were being questioned. The very nature of who they were was put on the front pages, back pages, was in press conferences and everything. So ultimately, it was only going to end one way. Listen, every Bulgarian representative that denied it is an absolute disgrace and should never be involved in football again. But UEFA have allowed that. And they've allowed it to fester, they've allowed it to grow, and they've allowed it to come out at a very important time. The onus will now be on them to see, you know, what actions they do take as they start to put out these fluffy statements again.
We'll get on to UEFA and exactly what their role has been in detail later in this pod. But what was it like in the stands? We've got Kevin Miles, Chief Executive of the Football Supporters Association, in the studio. Kevin, thanks so much for coming in. What was your experience of the night?
Well, it was a bit strange, if I can use the word, because the stadium itself is like a big open bowl with a running a track around it. It's not the most modern. I think they claim they'll have a fresh coat of paint since we were last there, you know, 8 years ago. But you wouldn't tell from where we were based in the corner. Next to us was this, to our left was the sector that was completely open because it was closed, the partial stadium closure. Mm-hmm. So that's where they had the UEFA respect banners up on the seats there to the left. To the right was the main stand, but it's a big open bowl, sparsely populated. There were two sections, apart from the main stand, there were two sections of home support, which are apparently different groups of ultras who on any other day are at loggerheads, so they can't be in the same part of the stadium together. And there was just two sectors. Across the far side of the pitch was the area where, infamously now, the stewards or those who've been working as stewards took their jackets off and joined in with that far-right ultra group who were Sieg Heiling and the source of much of the racist abuse. Across the other side, I think that's what we noticed, they were the ones who were displaying an England flag that they'd stolen upside down. But we were quite far removed from it. And while we had a good view of everything that was going on, we couldn't necessarily hear everything going on. We were the noisiest part of the ground, I think, by a stretch. We couldn't really hear much from the home supporters. Now, that might have had something to do with the way the game unfolded. Mm-hmm. They went behind quite early on. That shuts people up at the best of times. But what it meant was the whole thing about the racism stuff, we almost experienced that secondhand because we were aware of what was going on. We were aware of what had been said in advance of the game. But we could more likely, England fans where we were more likely to see Tyrone Mings' response to racist abuse than actually hear anything that was shouted or said towards him. And people were keeping in touch through social media, people texting from back home, telling us what was going on. That was more clear than what we could anything we'd actually hear in the ground.
And we hear this protocol and messages on the tannoy. Could you hear that?
No, well, certainly I couldn't. The tannoy just didn't seem to work at any stage, or not audibly for us. I mean, for all I know, in the main stand where the media were based, it was working perfectly as far as I can tell. But where we were in that open area, we couldn't hear a tannoy at all. It was things like at the end of the game, we were held back at the end of the game for half an hour in the stadium. Now, they're supposed to tell you that it's going to happen in the language of the visiting team. No announcement around that. We couldn't hear the anthems beforehand. I know there's been something made about English fans, you know, singing through the Bulgarian anthem. We heard enough to know that they were starting ours, and then obviously people joined in singing it, but they weren't in time with what was being played, as far as I can gather. We couldn't hear the Bulgarian anthem at all. And then when we could work out when there must have been a tannoy announcement taking place, just by watching what was happening on the benches with the players gathered around. We knew what the protocol was, but we couldn't hear a word of it. Nobody knew.
So from what you could see and what you could sense and what you were getting on social media, what sense did you get from the fans around you about the idea of the protocol and the idea of the players perhaps walking off and the pitch completely?
Well, I was very pleasantly surprised. I mean, I've been a sort of committed anti-racist campaigner for a long time, and I know that, you know, the England fans have had a bit of a bad press in the past as well, and some of it deservedly so. But I've also known that the big majority of English fans were not racist. It, what was we actually got for the first time there was an expression of quite vocal anti-racism. Now, it was for one occasion where, I mean, I sometimes worry about when incidents take place that the tribalism that exists in football sometimes might disrupt some of this sort of stuff and derail things. But on this one, the tribalism definitely worked in England fans' favour because it was, I've no doubt, for some, a stick to beat the Bulgarians with. But there was also a very strong sentiment of support for the team, particularly for the black players. I mean, it's little things, but you would never have got, I think, even a couple of years ago, the sort of support for Raheem Sterling that was voiced by the England fans. I mean, Raheem Sterling's had a bit of a difficult relationship with England fans. There's been a bit of a feeling, rightly or wrongly, that he didn't always perform for England like he did for Manchester City. But to have England fans singing Raheem Sterling, he's one of our own, I think was a, you know, marked a step forward. There was even bits of chanting, not as he taken up at the same scale, but of take them off. At one stage in the game, I think the England fan base there, alleviated, obviously helped by the fact that we were clearly the better team and already ahead on the night, that helped. But I think there would have been a general support for the idea of the team coming off on that occasion in those circumstances.
You've touched on that briefly, and we've spoken to you on this pod about the behaviour of England fans. Gareth Southgate and Greg Clark mentioned that we have problems here as well, and we don't want to single out Bulgaria, right? It's prompted this discussion, but we have seen racism at every level of English football as well. Do you think this incident will sharpen minds here?
I think it might. And I mean, it certainly focused on the question. There was definitely... See, I think we've done a good job in English football. It's never a job that's completed. As long as racism exists in society, there will be some reflection of that in the people's sport, whichever form that might take. But I think we've done a good job in the terms of creating a climate where the big majority of people that go to football find that unacceptable. And it's a question then of isolating, marginalising those few. And I think it does bring that to renewed focus. If anything, it might give a bit of a confidence to those of us who are speaking out against racism that we do have public opinion, fan opinion generally on our side. And it will focus attention on it because, you know, people in glass houses and we're throwing accusations about other people. However, I've also got to say that in this country, I'm a bit more confident that if there is a perpetrator of racist abuse in a football ground in this country, there is the legislation and there is the will to do something about it. I'm not convinced in Bulgaria that that's the case. I, generally speaking, I'm not a big fan of collective punishments. You know, punishing a whole fan base for the actions of a minority, for me, is very much a last resort. I'd far rather do what we tend to do here, which is identify individual perpetrators and ban them, rather than ban the whole lot. But I think in order to have that approach and to resist collective punishments here, like closing grounds or excluding from tournaments, you've got to be pretty confident that you can identify the perpetrators and do something with them. And I'm not sure that Bulgarian society generally, that the legal system, judicial system there, that the police, that the Football Association are all geared up and have the instruments in place to be able to deal with that. And I think until they have that, then maybe we need a really strong message, like exclude them from a tournament, to send a strong signal, not just to Bulgarians, but other nations like that, that you cannot just tolerate this and hope you get away with it.
Barney Ronnie said it was, in all the history of him watching football matches, was the worst he'd ever seen. Would you agree with that?
I've been to games where the racist abuse has been worse in the sense of more audible. I was in Madrid in 2004 at the Bernabeu, where the abuse of Ashley Cole, I think it was, particularly Sean Wright Phillips at that place, was louder, more audible. You could even hear it in the away end, whereas we couldn't do that in the stadium here. I remember Slovakia in, I think it was... Well, this not long after that, actually, Emil Heskey in particular, the racist abuse that he got when he was down injured was louder and probably more of the home fans joining in. So there have been worse examples in that sense. But what stood out with this one for me was a bit of a watershed moment. It's the first time I've heard the entire England fan base unanimously chanting anti-racist songs, chanting it against racism. You know, this you racist bastards, you know what you are. From the entire end, I think, yes, it's fed into by the tribalism, but it was a loud and unanimous voice. That singing about who put the ball in the racist net, Raheem Sterling, you know, that clear identification of the whole England fan base taking a position against racism, that's not happened before. Now, hopefully, that's the music of the future rather than just a one-off occasion to taunt your opposition with. But if that's the case, then I think there's something positive comes out of this.
Kevin, thanks so much for coming in.
You're welcome.
Kevin Miles there, Chief Executive of the Football Supporters Association. Let's talk about the protocol and how it was implemented on the night. On the line is the football writer and co-host of the Stadio podcast, Musa Okwonga. Musa, how are you doing?
Great, thanks. You well?
Yeah, really good, thanks. Thanks for coming on. Start with you, and I want to talk about like the reaction of the players and the players who had to suffer this abuse, right, and the players who backed them up. And to start sort of right at the beginning, and this might sound like a really simple question, you and Troy are both experts on the effects of racism. How can racist abuse affect an individual, Musa?
I think we look at it like the fact that these are workplace conditions, right? So if you play football in front of 80,000 people and you receive racist abuse, a lot of the time that will remind you of stuff you received during your childhood, or it will create an environment where you'll feel like actually it's an unsafe space to perform, not only that night, but, you know, after the game as well. And it's not just you that's receiving the abuse, it's your family, it's your friends who are watching the game. So you may be hardened to it, but there are people watching, you know, the grassroots of the game who have less protections than you do. And it creates a sense that if you have a game where racist abuse is tolerated of even the elite players, that trickles all the way down. We've seen this time and again, that abuse at the top level, if it's not handled, actually leads down. There's a great report actually by Jacob Steinberg of your own newspaper publication, the shocking amount of grassroots racism that you see in the game. So if you don't address it in front of 80,000 people, then it doesn't get addressed at Sunday league level either, ultimately.
You're right, Musa. And I was going to say, does the game care enough about the lower levels and what happens in you know, I've heard and seen and witnessed some horrendous situations down at that level where you're right, they've trickled down to the lower level because it's acceptable at the highest
exactly.
level. And my worry is that the events of the other night, again, could probably see a wave of events this weekend that would go completely underneath the radar.
Exactly. And this is the key point to make, because you might look at a game like that and say, well, look, they've got security, they've got a bunch of multimillionaire footballers, but we've seen that in the same way that people emulate goal celebrations by their favourite players, people emulate acts of extremism in the grounds. And, you know, I live in Germany, I live in Berlin, and a few hundred miles to the east, you've got black players playing in stadiums with much less security, much less safety, and this emboldens people in those atmospheres, extremely dangerous.
And remember Tammy Abraham, who said after the European Super Cup, after the penalty miss and the wave of social media abuse that he received, that he blanked out. But very importantly, like you said, his mum questioned him and said, why are people talking about you like that? Why are people using that kind of language? So actually, although she wasn't in the stadium or around the ground, like you said, the impact of that is so far reaching, and she was hurt, which then ultimately meant that Tammy was hurt, not by the abuse that he received, but by the fact that it had an impact on his mother.
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely.
Breaking it down to its bare elements, like we all know that monkey chants are wrong. Elliot, can you explain, I think we all probably know it, but the historical context of that?
Sure. I mean, the white supremacist idea that black people are somehow not human or less than human goes back a really long way, and it's often often been the case that there's been sort of like evolutionary type models, eugenics, this kind of thing has been used to try to say that there's like this separate category, right? So when people talk about these kinds of chants being dehumanizing, that's what they mean. So the what the chants are saying is not just like we don't like you, or anything like this. It's about trying to say that you belong in a different category. You don't. You're not entitled to the same rights and dignity and respect as a person, right? So that's why it's such a profound insult. And it's also such a profound insult because it ties back into really deep histories, right? So
yeah, yeah.
Most crucially, the histories of enslavement and the slave trade and of colonialism. So there are complicated but profound political and economic reasons why this kind of rhetoric has been so powerful and effective historically, right? So if you're going to turn people into a commodity to be traded, it helps if you know if you have a language and some kind of like justification for why those people aren't entitled to the same rights and protections as you are, right? And similarly, if you're going to go and invade someone's country and you're going to try and you're going to exploit people on a massive scale, take mm-hmm. away their land, etc. Again, it helps if your idea is fundamentally exactly. that these people are less than.
But can I jump in and Elliot, you've got a great explanation. I want to sort of add a Saturday night context. Let's imagine you've got a bunch of guys, a bunch of lads, and you want to attack someone, right? But that guy is like, let's say you just want to beat the hell out of someone, want to convince your mates to do it. The way to do that is to convince those people that that their suffering is not going to be that of one of your own mates.
Exactly.
So you have to convince, yeah, you've got to convince them that's a target worth picking on. So if you watch that, you know, that you read that book, Lord of the Flies, when they convince everyone that Piggy is just the kind of animal they should just stab, and they just tear him to pieces. And it's the same thing. It's like, when people are doing monkey chants, it's the same as those gassing noises that they do, or the Nazi salute. They're basically saying, 5 minutes from now, we're going to tear you to pieces. And you might say, oh, they're hardened footballers, they're in a stadium. But here's the thing. Certain players in that context, especially with environments of lower security, are thinking, I've got to get a bus through dark streets after this game. I've got to walk to and from the dressing room, you know, 10 meters from that abuse, and people are screaming that hatred in my face. And I think this is the key. Elliot, you've nailed it. This is a historical problem. And with the rising far right all around Europe, it's really important to come down against this, because football is an institution that can say, no, you don't turn people into animals as a prelude to beating the hell out of them, or worse.
Musa, I'm always confused with this. People label those people that you're talking about uneducated. Right. Is that correct?
Yeah, not at all.
Right.
They're highly educated.
Right.
For example, if you look in Germany right now, we have a guy, a professor of linguistics, Marcus Egg. He's the professor of linguistics at one of Berlin's most prestigious universities, and he's an active member of the AfD, Alternative for Germany party, the AfD party. So, you know, racists can come from all walks of life.
Mm.
You can be highly, in fact, the most highly educated racists in history have been the most dangerous.
Mm, mm. Thank you.
Can I go from this to the UEFA racism protocol? I'll just read it out. I'm sure a lot of people have heard it before. On the first occasion, quote, stop the match, instruct stadium authorities to read out an announcement calling on spectators to stop. That was enacted in the 25th minute after Tyrone Mings reported he'd heard racist abuse to an assistant referee. He also told Harry Kane, who in turn told Gareth Southgate. Second one, if this announcement does not work, the second step is to make another announcement, suspend the match and send the players to the dressing rooms for a specific period. The England players decided that with it being so close to half time, that they would rather just repeat step one instead of going off for 10 minutes, coming back on for four, and then going back off for 15 minutes. Third and finally, after consultation, abandon the match if discriminatory behaviour still does not cease or breaks out again. Musa, is that protocol sufficient? What message does it send to black players?
I think there's a couple of issues. The first is that the players themselves, and I was speaking to a friend about this the other day, felt empowered by the protocol. You know, there's a clear set of guidelines where there weren't before. So I think the appearance, the visibility and the appearance of protocol, I think in itself is a positive step. I'm not sure the mechanisms are necessarily right. I'm not sure that racism should be given a yellow card when it's as extreme as it was the other day. But I feel that, I mean, I think it's a bit like VAR. I think it's an imperfect way to address a real problem. And I think we're in the process of perfecting it. But what I will say is that the players that came out afterwards and the way they spoke about it, they were there to get a job done. And they were almost like, you know, we've got this. We feel empowered by the structure and we've got this. Now, there might be environments where actually you might say we go straight to, we don't need that sort of second stage of, oh, let's see if it gets better. Because frankly, if an audience, if a crowd is that empowered, they're going to be chanting to that extent. I think it might have made sense to sort of pull them straight out of it. But I think my initial feeling, to be honest, and I know that people like Marvin Sordell and Ennio De Luca, who I very much respect and agree with, might disagree on this, but I feel like as imperfect as this protocol is, I think it was a useful step forward.
Musa, I've got to be honest, I struggled with the protocol in seeing it in action. I applauded the first stage because actually it was almost the first time that the public, the audience, the people watching could visibly see something in action challenging the racial discrimination that everybody heard and also the other actions that were going on the night. I struggled at what was the proposed step two. And the reason I struggled, because that shouldn't have been in the England players' hands to say there's only 4 minutes to go. If we're following a protocol, why do we repeat step one? But we didn't actually repeat step one because there was not a further stadium announcement. There was a stoppage of the game, just seemed like a conversation. And then the players went back out again. So if we're going to follow protocol, stage two, and Max has said it, is off the pitch, stadium announcement, which is actually the last part of this game is going to be abandoned. And so let's... And that's when I lost all faith in it again. And for me, that was UEFA almost saying, well, hold on, if we initiate step two, we're very close to having to abandon this game. And we all know it continued it continued in the second half.
I tweeted out during the game that, you know, I'd never seen this before. I think we're all going, wow, I've never seen this. This is, you know, this is a start. A black guy replied to me on Twitter saying, a start? You know, it's 2019. I am tired. How can this be a start? Yeah. And I was like, you know, like we're all trying to sort of work this out as we go along. And I sort of felt, shit, you're right. You know,
I think that's really perceptive, Max. And I think that I used to live in the States, and one phrase that you see all the time, whenever an issue comes up is, oh, we're trying to start a conversation about race, or it's time to start a conversation about race. And this is just straight up gaslighting.
Yeah.
I think a lot of people are reaching the point where they've just had enough.
Well, let's be honest. This protocol is 10 years in, by the way. It's 10 years in.
And they've been talking about zero tolerance for 10 years as well, at least.
Well, can I say this? And actually, just to clarify as well, I agree with that critique of the protocol in the sense that it feels like it's a kind of, again, giving racism the yellow card. We've organised this big, lovely game, and we don't want to really ruin it unless absolutely necessary, but actually the essence of it has been ruined. The spectacle has already been destroyed. So I think this needs a rework. And so, don't get me wrong, I love the protocol for the fact that Tyrone Mings had, you know, a quick and ready procedure that he could follow. To that extent, I appreciate it, but I think this whole fudging of the issue really didn't help at all.
So I just want to clarify, what happens if the England players in the dressing room make a different decision and they decide we're not coming out? What happens? What are the rules? What happens to the game? Do they replay it? Is it, are the points?
I don't think they've got to that stage, have they? I mean,
there's certainly no talk of disqualification.
No, but if England hadn't come out, they haven't enacted step three.
No.
So I personally, if they're going to go by their own rules, England are in trouble. But, I'm not so sure.
But is it more important, right, as you were saying there, Moose, is it more important to walk off and make the statement and sod whatever UEFA say? Because you can understand, like, I totally understand in that dressing room, they are footballers and then they're in the middle of a football match and that is what they do. And they go, and obviously we don't know the egos in that dressing room. We don't know if any of the black players felt they couldn't say, actually, I really want to go off. We just don't know. But I can see why them as professional footballers said, I want to show them on the pitch, which
Ben, here's the thing. And here's the thing then. Here's the key issue. It shouldn't be to the footballers. Then. Right.
Yeah.
They should be disappointed. They should come out in those interviews and be like, we're so angry. We didn't get to finish the job. But like, here's the thing. If this is about workplace safety, right? If we're serious about workplace safety, how often in any working conditions do the workers get to say ultimately what the conditions are, whether they're safe or not? You don't. Yeah. If you're constructing a stadium, You don't say, oh, you can climb on that ladder, even though it's rickety. Oh, but I've got two more nails to put in. No, you're going to fall off and you're going to break your neck. Like, and I'm here as the project manager or as the person surveying the area, and that's UEFA's job. So actually what they're doing, and this is very, I'm going to be harsh on UEFA here, there's a lot of people in very high positions who are avoiding conversations about this. And this is a situation where workers, unfortunately, are being called upon to improve their own working conditions, and that's unacceptable. That's why this protocol fundamentally, you know, I have an issue with it.
Yes, Musa, also, Tyrone Mings told us that the chanting was when they were warming up.
Yeah.
Right. Tyrone Mings then had to inform the an official of what he heard while he's trying to concentrate on the game, which also meant that surely that official would heard that anyway. So I'm saying, is there a blind eye until it's actually, we're going to be told? So it's taken the black players to tell them. Are they turning a blind eye, hoping that no one says anything?
Can I say something as well? We got very lucky here. We got very lucky here with the players who are playing on that pitch, right? Imagine if somebody in that team had had relatives who, you know, were killed in some genocide or relevant to the Holocaust. And you've got Nazi salutes who are saying that UEFA exposed players to that.
Yeah.
That is really, if we're really thinking about, we got lucky with these players. And Southgate, the irony is, as Gareth, I think, pointed out, these players were fine because they're hardened to racism they've experienced in their own country. Mm. That phrase, and I think Jonathan Padukba highlighted that on Twitter. Jonathan highlighted it, and I'm glad he did it. That is the key phrase. We got lucky because our players are hardened by the racism they've experienced in the UK itself. Like, we're not going to be so lucky with other players.
Can we talk about that quote, I said it, beat them on the pitch thing? You know, Elliot, you mentioned the Daily Mail headline, England 6, racism 0, but the result of the game shouldn't make a difference. You know, England could have been playing a better team and been losing, right? Yeah.
All that stuff has to be secondary, I think, particularly if you're going to kind of live up to the talk of zero tolerance, right? I think, like, one thing that's also very clear, and I think this is a point that Lilian Thuram has made, is that with these kinds of conversations, and I think also kind of we're at the point now where the protocols themselves put far too much onus on the victims, like in the moment that they're being abused, to make a call one way or another. And I think structurally, whether that's in terms of like a national team and how they organize themselves, how they take these decisions, the onus has to be taken off of those players. And I'd like to see a lot more leadership and frank talk and action from white players and white officials and white coaches, right?
Because, and directors, yeah. Yeah.
Well, I as a white middle-aged man, don't feel it's my place to tell black footballers how they or anyone else how they should react to racism. I would feel, you know, well, who am I to tell them how they should react? The thing about the workplace safety aspect, I mean, I totally get what Moose is saying, but, you know, as workplaces go, it's quite a weird one. You know, I work in an office and I don't have a crowd of 80,000 people providing a running commentary on what I'm doing as I do it. And you can have a hostile environment in a football ground without anyone being racist, just being antagonistic and full of fervor. And in which case the player's safety can also be possibly compromised. But, you know,
It's a very I understand the point that
it's an unorthodox workplace.
Yeah. Here's the thing. Here's something else I want to mention as well. It's not about you being a white man telling a black person how they should feel about racism. In the same way that if there is an environment, let's say you've got. Here's another example. As a man, I can still comment on misogyny. I can still comment on situations, environments where violent misogyny is more likely than others, right? And I can say this area, this part of town is not safe. Let's say I'm a male architect. I don't go, oh, I'm not going to design an area which is safer for women because I'm not a woman. You don't do that. It's right. More about what are the standards, what is, and it's not even just about safety as well, it's about workplace dignity.
But would you not be inclined to defer to the opinion of women in that incident? In that case, well, because they have a better perception of what is involved, maybe, than you do.
Not always, because not every black person, as we've seen with recent racial commentary, actually has the best interests of black people in mind.
I don't know what you're talking about.
Well, I'm not going to name names, but careful consultation. It's about careful consultation with the affected groups. And of course, they are the primary witnesses. But then you also, with careful consultation, it's like the Human Rights Accords, right? You talk to indigenous people, you talk to trans people, you talk to black people, straight people, all the rest, and you come together and you form these common accords. And I think ultimately, when you form the common accords with consultation as the governing body, you then put in these protocols. And they're for the safety and dignity of everyone. And some people aren't going to like it. Some people are going to say, oh, well, you're stopping my right to freedom of expression. Some people are going to say, I could have handled the racism. And you say, listen, this isn't just about you. This isn't just about you scoring a hat trick in front of 80,000 people. This is about the grassroots who don't have the support and the networks that you have. It's about their dignity being protected. So when you say, sorry, this is important. This is really important. When you say we're going to shut the stadium down because there's five Nazi salutes, we're not saying you're not tough enough to handle five swastikas being waved at you. You're saying this is a statement from our society and our institution as a football club to the rest of society about what we will and will not accept on football pitches anywhere in the world. That is extremely powerful.
Moussa, listen, thank you so much for joining us.
Yeah. Sorry about that. It was a bit of a rant.
No. It was perfect, mate. It was perfect. Thank you. Moussa Kwonga there. Football journalist, co-host of the Stadio podcast as well. Right, let's look forward now. Starting with this. Was Monday night then actually momentous in any way? People have said this is a watershed moment. Troy, is it?
I would have said yes if they had gone through the three stages and abandoned the game. Because officially, by their own language, by their own rules, that game should have been abandoned. They have now... There's more questions coming out of that game than answers. You know, what's happened with the Bulgarians now, with resignation and whatever else is going on, is just part of the game that I think that the Bulgarian people in authority are playing to make it seem like they are doing something.
Right, because on the face of it, I was like, well, actually, the protocol was initiated, and if it hadn't been, I don't think the head of the Bulgarian FA would have been asked to resign. So it felt to me like, oh, well, this is, like, one again, oh, this is a start. I'm using that phrase again.
I think something had to give. I think after the embarrassment of the game, the embarrassment of the press conference afterwards and obviously the language and the disrespect that the Bulgarian media were now, doing to Gareth and his staff. For me, the next day is all part of a game. Let's get rid of him. Let's raid the FA offices. They knew that anyway, but there was a consequence now to the actions of Monday night. And then you get to the bit where UEFA come out and now start talking about a football family again. You know, so they're now talking about a football family and they can't deal with this alone. Well, if you had put effective measures in from the very outset, well, maybe we wouldn't be talking about a football family. Everybody knows that this is a challenge for everybody, not just football. It's a challenge for society, and we talk about the influence of the game. They've let the players down again. Let's not forget, we're not many months away from Montenegro. And what happened out there? So we will only know when they finally start to distribute the sanctions that will come from this.
So UEFA has opened disciplinary proceedings against both Bulgaria and England. Bulgaria have been charged with racist behaviour, throwing of objects, disruption of a national anthem, as well as an offence in the category of replays on giant screen.
You mean there wasn't a cat around at a time that they could find the cat as well?
England have also been charged with two offences, disruption of the national anthem and for sending an insufficient number of stewards. As we've mentioned, the Bulgarian Prime Minister told Borislav Mihailov, the head of the Bulgarian FA, to step down. The police have raided their FA's offices. Four Bulgarian football fans suspected of subjecting black England players to racist abuse have been detained following police raids. We're all waiting for the UEFA sanction, see what they do. What do you think they'll do, and what should they do, Elliot?
I think Bulgaria should be disqualified, and I think that they'll receive a small five-figure fine.
As in disqualified from this, or because FIFA said they'd follow whatever UEFA said, so disqualified from the next?
Let's forget FIFA at the moment. Let's forget FIFA at the moment.
Okay.
I agree with Elliot. I think it should be, listen, have they got any points? I'm not even sure if they've got any points, but listen, expulsion from this tournament and a warning for the UEFA Champions League, because it's still a UEFA competition, that if they do not get their house in order, which apparently they're starting to do, that their place could be taken away from the UEFA Champions League and the next Euro qualifiers as well. If you are really serious about this problem that they have already been warned about, you know, they're a partially closed stadium anyway, then you have to take the strongest possible action. If this time around there is that five-figure sum, I actually think not that I think that UEFA care, but I actually think that the football fraternity will actually get together and you know, ask for heads to roll.
Sure. Discounting what governing bodies will do, and this is not an easy question to answer, I'm sure, what would be the most effective way of stamping out racism in football? Not just in Bulgaria, not just in England, but everywhere. I mean, Troy, I suppose if we knew the answer, we'd be...
Yeah,
we'd come and work for you, couldn't we?
Well, I wouldn't be in a job, I don't think. The most effective way, after, you know, years of trying to challenge this problem, after hearing the horrendous stories that I hear, after witnessing what I witnessed Monday night, the biggest impact from Monday night would have been England to have said, thanks very much, we're not going to continue. For me, I think that opens them up to more sanctions. People will say, well, the loss of 3 points. Well, England are going to qualify for the Euro Championships anyway, aren't they? So I don't think it puts their position in jeopardy. People from grassroots will say to me, Troy, we've walked off a pitch before, and because of the FA rule, E, whatever, we've been fined more than the perpetrators. So we have to be careful. Can the football industry change its rules? Of course it can. It can change its rules whenever it wants to. Does it want to? Does it want to be effective enough to appreciate this area that has gone for far too long now without real action and authority? And that's probably the question back to them, if I ever had the chance to.
Yeah, I mean, I think football has an interesting opportunity. I mean, people point out correctly that there's, you know, the racism in society is expressed through football, but football has now become, I think, just a kind of hyper-visible space where these issues get discussed. I thought it was really interesting, you know, Barry brought up Boris Johnson earlier in the pod, and Boris, who didn't have any idea who Nagamon Chetty even was quite happy to kind of weigh in on football. So it's a space where, however we got here, football is a frame through which a lot of important questions about racism historically, culturally, racism in the workplace, how to respond. Like, I think it has that opportunity, and I think that the framing around zero tolerance, like if we're gonna stick to that, then that means that the first principle is that we don't have racism in football. The game doesn't happen. It simply doesn't take place if that's what's going to be happening in stadiums or on the field. That I think what people fail to appreciate is that is quite radical. That's a very high bar within Europe, within institutions that are dominated and have long been dominated by white people, with the assumptions that we are socialized with growing up. So yeah, I think that's going to be difficult. I think there's also questions here about, you know, we were talking about like the kinds of conversations that go in within UEFA, and I think it's very often assumed that they would see this as a kind of a blight on the product and on their marketing. But equally, it really gets people talking. It gets football on the front pages as well as the back pages. I'm sometimes skeptical about just how wary they are of these incidents kind of sullying the brand that they're there to promote.
Now that protocol has been initiated once, do we think it could happen a lot of times? I was just thinking about the England fans singing the 10 German Bombers song in Germany. Presumably that should initiate the protocol, shouldn't it, by the letter of it?
I would have thought so, no? Or not, Barry?
I don't know. Does that count as racism?
Discrimination.
It's discriminatory. You know, England fans, a section of England fans habitually misbehave on their travels. Their behaviour is kind of antisocial, more so than, you know, actively racist. They sing their songs. You know, it's just kind of semantics, I suppose, whether or not they're racist. But I don't see why England should escape punishment for what goes on, you know, in town centres where their fans misbehave on a grand scale, you know, commit acts of vandalism, disrespect the locals, public displays of, you know, extreme drunkenness. Should England be punished for that? I think so. But you don't hear calls from England fans. You know, you don't see England fans getting upset about it. It's mentioned. I mean,
that's the thing. I think you get upset. But then you said this to me. We were discussing it on Twitter during the game. And my first reaction was it's different. But I couldn't actually put my finger on.
I don't see that it is different, to be honest. Because you could set your watch by these bozos. You know, England travel abroad to a European city. A few thousand turn up. They occupy the square. They hang their flags. They vandalise things. Sometimes there's acts of hooliganism and racism. Other times it's just generally antisocial behaviour. But I think England should be sanctioned for that. Or any team whose fans behave in that way.
The problem for me is that very often we dilute racism. We dilute it and we compare it to something else and the way that we deal with something else. We've never effectively got to the bottom of how we deal with racism. So whilst, listen, I agree with you know, England fans and how they go and destroy beautiful cities, etc., and I'm not condoning that for one minute. Racism is an issue that actually, you know, the responsibility has never been, we never know who's responsible, and we never know, you know, how we treat the issue and how we, you know, how we deal with it and how we try and make the game better. People believe that we had a period when racism went away. People believe that racism has only just come up again because of Brexit. People believe that racism, like black people are making things up in their heads. So let's treat racism how it is in isolation by itself, rather than compare it to other areas and then decide that actually, like UEFA have done, it's because of, or we're just going to bunch it in with the national anthem and the stewarding and stuff like that. And for me, there should be a special meeting by UEFA over the next couple of days to deal with what happened in that stadium, the specific nature of what made the protocol be, you know, be put in place. That's how it should be. That shows me that they are serious about the issue. Not a special meeting that will put 25,000 against racism, another 5,000 against the cat that walked across the pitch, and another 1,000 against some poor stewarding. Treat it as it deserves to be treated, and actually do something about it immediately rather than let it fester along again.
So finally, and to loop back to an earlier question, was this a watershed moment, and does anyone feel hopeful about the future? Elliot?
I don't feel particularly hopeful about the future. was it a watershed moment? I very much doubt it. I think there's a question here about like how much we're willing to disrupt what we're used to about football as a spectacle, as a game, as a leisure pursuit. I can't remember who it was that raised VAR as an example.
Moussa
was talking about that. Yeah, like that. The trade-off there, as everyone knows, right, was that you're going to massively disrupt what we're used to seeing, but we're going to have like a slightly higher percentage of like right calls, right? And I don't actually think that's a trade-off that's worth making. We don't want to get into that argument, right? It just seems to be really clear that in this case, the trade-off is one that's worth making, right? If we can make football, if we can work to make football a space where unlike many other sectors of our society, people and black people in particular do not need to suffer racist abuse, racist aggression. That would be remarkable, but it can't be business as usual. The ordinary rules of the game just don't apply.
The cynic in me thinks it won't be a watershed moment. There'll be stirring polemics, well written and well thought out, in the Sunday papers by some of our the good and the great of the sports journalism world, then it'll kind of be forgotten about because something will happen when the Premier League resumes this weekend and that will divert everyone's focus. I can't see UEFA doing anything particularly radical, and I'd imagine in a year's time nothing much will have changed, but I would be absolutely thrilled to be proved wrong. The only thing I would say is if we get the racism out of the football grounds, which would be wonderful, the racist people will still be racist, you know, that education is required.
I think I've said it more than enough. I don't think it was a watershed moment. I suppose we'll appreciate and understand more when the sanctions come through. In a year's time, I would hope that maybe various figures that are at the top of the game at the moment are not here anymore. And that maybe would mean then that we have better reflection of people who actually appreciate and understand more about what happened on Monday night, more about what has continued to happen throughout the many years in the game, and would actually then be able to affect the change that is needed for this game to at least start to eliminate the elements that it has in it, which would then hopefully empower the game to have more of an influence back into society, because it's not having that. It is having an influence, but it's having a negative influence at the moment. So for me, if change doesn't happen at the top, or the change of thinking doesn't happen at the top, we are just going to swim along and be talking about these incidents again and again and again.
Listen, thanks so much for your time today. Elliot, thanks so much for coming in.
Cheers. Thanks, Max.
Thank you, Troy.
Absolute pleasure.
Thank you, Barry.
You're welcome.
We will be back with Football Weekly Extra tomorrow.
For more great podcasts from The Guardian, just go to theguardian.com/podcasts.